You are listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Randall White. When the federal government incarcerated more than 100,000 Japanese Americans during World War II, many had to leave virtually everything they owned behind to head to the camps where they would live until the war ended. In total, these people lost between $2 and $5 billion worth of property. That's in 2017 dollars, according to the Commission on the Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians. These losses included homes, farms, businesses, and personal effects, but it's complicated to trace what happened to this property once people left. In this installment of our Great Question series, listener Andy Hesse wondered about this, so he asked, what happened to the property of Japanese Americans in Sacramento who were incarcerated during World War II? Cap Radio's Emily Zentner has researched the answer and researched the answer and researched it and is here now. Emily, before we get started on this, can you describe the Great Question series for listeners who may not yet know about it?
Yeah, so our Great Question series is a series where our listeners pose questions to us about things that they're interested in about the Sacramento region. And then our reporters go through the questions and we choose a set number of questions and we answer them.
I've been a part of the process and
yes.
I enjoy it. It's my favorite type of story to do. And it is a process for deciding which questions get answered.
Yes. Yeah. So the big thing for me is it interesting and is it answerable? Because as you know, because you've done it, some of the questions, it's just not possible for us to find the answer to them.
Even if at the beginning you think it's answerable, then when you start digging, maybe it's not
yeah.
so much.
Yeah. So for this one, we actually do what we call a voting round. So I picked my three favorite questions that we'd gotten that were history related. And we created a little poll with the tool that we use for Great Question, which is called Harkin. And people voted. And this one won by like 70%, I think. It was
wow.
overwhelming for this question.
A lot of support for this one. So
yes.
Let's hear from the original question asker. Who was it again?
Yes. So Andy Hesse reached out with the question. And he was just a kid when the incarceration happened. And he wondered about it. So he asked this question to us.
What happened to the property of Japanese Americans that were interned during World War II?
All right. So, Emily, you got that question. Our listeners overwhelmingly voted for it. Where did your reporting lead you?
Yeah. So I actually reached out to a former coworker of mine named Paul Kitagaki Jr., and he told me to reach out to Julie Thomas, who works here at Sacramento State University, and she's an archivist with their collection focused on Japanese Americans in the Sacramento area. So I reached out to Julie, and she was able to give me a lot of great information about this.
And Julie joins us in studio as well right now. Julie, welcome to Cap Radio Insight. Great to have you here.
Thanks for inviting me.
Hey, before we get started, can we discuss language just a bit, specifically the difference between internment and incarceration?
I'd be happy to. During the whole incarceration period, actually, the government was playing with words. So even today, they're called relocation centers. That's how the Library of Congress refers to it. But relocation is actually somebody who's got a new job and they're moving across country. And now internment camp seems to be the name that everybody is using. But internment is not adequate to describe what happened. And if you ask the incarcerees and scholars, they agree. The word is actually concentration camp. It's the word they used. But then they started hearing about what was happening in Germany, who were playing with words as well. Those were death camps. But the government wanted to change that narrative, so they started calling it internment camp. And camp in and of itself, when people think of camp, they think about horseback riding and making pottery. So a group of scholars, as well as incarcerees, they decided to, at this point, call it incarceration centers and incarcerees.
So for the purpose of this conversation, we'll use the term incarceration today. If people are curious, because they've heard that internment word over and over again, so that we just wanted to sort of lay that groundwork. In specific, you run the Japanese American archival collection at Sac State. Help us define how much property was lost when Japanese Americans were incarcerated.
Well, the property, it's approximately, as you said, 85%. But there's more than just property itself.
85% of what they left behind, they didn't get back.
That's correct, okay. In rough figures. But like everybody's belongings, they're personal too. So things, the cars they had to sell beforehand for 5 cents or $5. Somebody might have just purchased a new refrigerator and they had to leave that behind. And how do you put a price on pets? They weren't allowed to bring any of their pets. So that's the type of property. Mm. And the number of incarcerees from Sacramento specifically was over 5,000, almost 5%. Of the 120,000 incarcerees are from Sacramento, and a little over 7,700 from the Sacramento area.
So nearly 8,000, and that would include Davis, Roseville, Auburn.
Correct.
Those areas. We're speaking with Cap Radio's Emily Zentner and archivist Julie Thomas about the property of Japanese Americans interned or incarcerated during World War II. We're now also joined by Marielle Tsukamoto, one of the nearly 8,000 Sacramentans who were incarcerated. Welcome, Marielle.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
It's terrific to have you. Your family was sent to the camps when you were 5 years old. You had to leave the property, the family farm out in Florin. What is your memory of that day?
Well, I remember having to get up early in the morning. It was still dark. It was a Sunday, I think the end of May. And my grandparents lived with us. I went outside to get my grandmother to let her know it was time to leave. And she stood there looking at her rose garden, crying and saying she didn't think she was going to come back. And I remember taking her hand and telling her, yes, you will come back. We will be okay. And she did come back alive.
And you were able to come back to the land that you left. How did that happen?
Well, that was because my dad asked someone that he worked with, Bob Fletcher, who was not a farmer, but had grown up on a farm in Brentwood, was a state fruit inspector. You know, my dad worked for my uncle who owned a shipping company, and there were the Union Station and the Southern Pacific Railway had a shed at Florin, and they would ship strawberries, grapes, the products that were farmed in the area to the East Coast. Bob was one of the fruit inspectors. And when we were told we were going to leave, my dad understood that someone had to take care of the farm. Someone had to pay the mortgage and the taxes. And so he asked Bob not just to take care of our farm, but primarily to take care of our neighbor and our cousin's farm, Mr. Nitta. And if he had time, my dad asked Bob to take care of our farm. Well, Bob did that. And most of the people did lose their property. And primarily because they couldn't pay the mortgage, they couldn't pay the taxes.
Without Mr. Fletcher, you would have lost your property.
Without him, yes.
Were there legal ramifications for him to do something like that? Was the law such that he wasn't supposed to do what he was doing? Or it just didn't? It's
my understanding that there was no law prohibiting someone from taking care of the land or whatever. In fact, the Growers Association in Florin, which was primarily, the members were mostly Japanese because about 90% of the population in our area were Japanese. The Growers Association agreed to take care of the farms, rent them out, and have the people who are renting it take care of the taxes. Well, whatever happened, they didn't do that. So the people that were assigned to take care of the farms, they actually ended up letting the farms be sold to someone else. Mm-hmm. and they were sold for non-payment of taxes, which meant that all you had to do was pay the taxes that were due on the property to obtain it.
And it was yours.
You could obtain it for a very low price. But Bob kept his promise. And I know it was difficult because Florin was one of the hot spots in which a lot of the people that lived here, the Caucasians, were happy that we were leaving, would be glad to have us never come back. And Bob never talked about that part. I do know that, you know, Bob was married at the time, and his first wife didn't want to stay there. I'm sure there were people in the community that objected to Bob taking care of our land.
And there were, Marielle. In fact, Julie, I want to bring you back in because you have a resolution that was passed. And this is for the city of Sacramento, Sacramento County, and the state of California. And if you could just read that first portion there, we're not going to read it in its entirety, but these are really powerful words that were passed in 1943. Is that right?
Correct. May 28th, 1943, it was adopted. And the wording goes as thus, whereas the atrocious conduct of the Japanese at Pearl Harbor and the murder of the aviators recently acknowledged and even flaunted in the faces of law-abiding nations has brought sharply to the attention of the American people the treachery, faithlessness, and untrustworthiness of the pagan Japanese and Sacramento people being thoroughly conversant with the conduct of these undesirable people, be it resolved that we are opposed to the return of any Japanese from concentration camps to their former locations.
Here's what's shocking about that. Not only, so what Marielle was saying is in print right here.
Yes.
From 1943. When did that get rescinded?
May 2014.
2014. 5 years ago, almost
correct.
To the day.
Correct.
Incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So, Marielle, your family got the land back, and most of your possessions, I imagine. Emily, you spoke with Lester Uchida. His family was also able to keep their property when they were incarcerated. What was his family's story?
So the Uchida's story is actually fairly similar to Marielle's, where they had a Caucasian neighbor named Mary McCumber, and she actually rented their home out to a minister during the war. And when they came back, they were able to move back in. So I will let Lester tell you a little bit more about that.
She rented our house for us for the 3.5 years that we were away, and sent the rent money to my father. So that was fortunate. And some others had, you know, same kind of thing, but others didn't have that closeness to a Caucasian family, so they, you know, struggled, or they might have even lost their homes. Yeah.
Marielle, Lester's your cousin?
Yes.
It's a small world, right?
It really is.
Marielle, you're a docent at the California Museum, where you talk to young students about what happened to your family. Why do you feel it's important to share your story?
Unfortunately, history has a tendency to repeat itself. And in 1983, my mother started a program to talk about what happened to Japanese Americans, and 70% of us were American citizens, how this was in violation of constitutional rights. We didn't get due process. We were taken from our homes, and we lost our property. And she felt that we needed not only to tell the story to the future generations, to inform them of what happened historically, but to prepare them for the next event. And it is true. After 9/11, history is continuing to repeat itself. Today, with the issue of immigration and families of immigrants trying to escape the death and destruction of their own country, coming here, being separated, and the children being incarcerated, and some who are in Crystal City, Texas, which was used as one of the camps or incarceration centers during World War II, which housed not only Japanese but a few German and Italian immigrants. Children are separated, and there are children in that same camp today. So, yes, it was the intent of the program. It was, unfortunately, a vision that my mother had that history would be repeated. We need to understand what our constitutional rights are. And if we're not willing to speak out, not only for ourselves, but the person who is our neighbor, the person who is someone coming into this country, our country will not be the same.
Mariel, do you feel this is being taught properly in schools to California school children, or are they hearing this for the first time when they come into your place?
It depends on the school district. The Elk Grove Unified School District, since 1983, passes a resolution every year supporting this program and teaching not only about what happened in history, but making sure that the children understand that as Americans, we not only have a right, but we have an obligation and a duty to protect our Constitution, or it will change.
Have you been back to the incarceration center where you and your family were sent?
Yes. The center is gone, but John Ellington, who was a young boy, now owns the land that was once the camp. And the partner camp in Arkansas, which was called Roarer, was preserved and saved by Rosalie Gould. So it's interesting that the two camps in Arkansas were preserved and saved by non-Japanese.
And we have a couple here in California as well, right?
Yes, there's one at Tule Lake, which is near the Oregon border, and Manzanar, which is in the mountains near Bishop. And those two camps are, Manzanar is a national park, and Tule Lake is a national historic site under the park system. So those two camps are also being preserved. They're rebuilding some of the buildings that were there and holding education programs. So, yes, there is an attempt to educate the people of California and the area about what happened to us and hopefully prevent a similar occurrence.
Mariel, thank you. Emily, do you feel Andy's question got answered thoroughly?
I do. It's a complicated answer, and I think we gave him a complicated answer, but I feel like we were able to address the question.
Well, it's just been a pleasure speaking with all three of you about this. I really love Cap Radio's Great Question series. We get down to things that aren't necessarily breaking news of the day, but it's on our minds, and so that's part of it. We've been speaking about the property of Japanese Americans interned or incarcerated during World War II. Our guests have been Cap Radio's Emily Zentner, Sacramento State Archivist Julie Thomas, and Mariel Tsukamoto, who was incarcerated along with her family. Thanks so much to all three of you for being on Insight. We have more on our website, capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. Thank you.